From Radio Vermont, it's the Dave Graham Show on WDEV. It's your show about the people, places, and the issues that matter the most to you. Now here's your host, Dave Graham.
Good morning, Vermont. It is Wednesday morning, August the 7th, 2019. Welcome to the Dave Graham Show here on WDEV FM and AM. So glad to have you with us. We have a good show lined up for you today. Sawyer Loftus is a young reporter with the Burlington Free Press who's, I think, is going to be joining us right off the top of the show here to talk about an article he had in yesterday's paper. And he is he wrote about the Department of Motor Vehicles and getting ordering up some facial recognition software, even though using that facial recognition software appears to be illegal under Vermont law. So there's a little bit of a gap between the actual activities of our government and the laws governing those activities, it would appear. And we're going to be finding out from Sawyer Loftus what the heck's going on there. In the second part of the first hour, we're going to be talking with a couple of longtime legislators actually one of them has not been in that long. Debbie Ingram, senator from Chittenden County, is a fairly new state senator, but she is somebody who's involved and interested in this topic of should the dual enrollment program, that's the word I'm looking for. Had a blank there for a minute. The dual enrollment program that allows high school kids to take some college classes, get some college credits, all for free. Should that be available to students who attend religious schools? There's an argument that public money that supports that should not be going to support students at religious schools. And others are saying, well, that's not fair. If public school and independent school students are able to avail themselves of this program, students at schools like Rice Memorial High School in South Burlington, Catholic High School there, should be able to partake as well. And so we're going to be discussing that. There's actually both legislation and a court case pending on this topic, and we're going to be fleshing it out a little bit and talking with both Debbie Ingram, senator from Chittenden County, and Dave Sharp, a retired legislator who former longtime chair of the House Education Committee, who has some negative things to say about the idea of allowing religious high school students, or students at religious high schools, I should say, to participate in the program that allows kids to take some college courses early. Later on in the program, we're going to stay on the higher education theme a little bit and talk with Scott Giles of the Vermont Student Assistance Corporation about what families need to be thinking about this time of year as they may be preparing to send students to college or back to college. How are we paying for it? Student loans and grants and other things that VSAC is so helpful with for folks. We're going to be hearing some about that from Scott Giles in the second hour of the program today. But let's get right into it with Sawyer Loftus of the Burlington Free Press, who I believe is on the phone with us now this morning. Good morning, Sawyer.
Good morning, Dave.
And wanted to talk with you about that story you had in the paper yesterday. It was pretty striking. It seems as though there's a very specific state law on something, and then there are policies or activities going on by state officials that don't seem to square with the law. What's going on?
Yeah, so the story that came out yesterday was the third story I have written about this sort of saga around the Vermont DMV's former use of a facial recognition software that first came to light through there was a lot of coverage back in 2017 when the ACLU first brought that to the attention of Governor Scott, who subsequently suspended the program. And then recently, the Washington Post and the New York Times published articles about it too. But anyways, this third, to get to the point of this third story, it seems that there was a contract signed in 2018 with a company, as part of that contract, there was an allocation for the potential to create a new facial recognition system, with the caveat that it won't be used until legislation changes.
And this contract is for how much money?
So the contract is for over $6 million, and the whole contract is not about facial recognition. The whole contract is for the entire credentialing system for the Department of Motor Vehicles. So it's essentially the system that creates and holds all the information for Vermont drivers and their driver's licenses. And this was one of the portions of that contract.
So basically, this is the company that would maintain, say, the database that would contain all the information on people's driver's licenses, right?
So the way it works, officials from the DMV explained to me, is that this company is developing it and has been in the process of developing a system for the Department of Motor Vehicles to use, and then it's ultimately the DMV's job and other agencies in the state government to maintain it. And that was an important question that I asked when I had the opportunity to sit down with officials from the DMV and Secretary Flynn from the Agency of Transportation was, you know, you're using this outside company to develop this program. Who has access to Vermonters' data? And the answer is, you know, this private company is, yes, developing that, but ultimately the people who maintain and operate it daily are the Vermont DMV.
Okay, but this outside company also has access to the data. Do they have any intention, or is there anything barring them from using this data in other ways that may be of their own creation and not even listed in the state contract?
I think you'd have to, like, really read it line by line, but from my indication from the contract, there isn't. And that additionally, you know, in talking to the company, their main goal is just to, like, use and design their they call it on-the-shelf products. So they have software that's essentially, you know, already pre-built, and then what's added is the individual state's data. And so essentially, it's kind of, it's ready to go. It would only take, specifically for the facial recognition program, it would only take, you know, less than a year to integrate Vermont's data into that program. And to answer your question more specifically, I asked the company, you know, does the federal government have the ability to, you know, either through a subpoena or a warrant, access Vermont's information? And the answer was no.
Well, I mean, here's what's the other thing that's odd about this to me. Tell me if I'm reading this right, but it seems as though you have a group of government officials who have this idea that they want to use facial recognition software in connection with the motor vehicles database. The legislature has said, let's not do this. And the hope is among the executive branch officials that the legislature will change its mind sometime in the near future and that they can go ahead and start doing this with the facial recognition software. Am I on track so far?
That's absolutely correct. That's a perfect way to sum up the story, is that there are a group of key officials within the executive branch who have been working to, you know, apparently to work to change legislation. But when I talked to the top legislators that came to my mind as the people who would be the ones working on this, so I reached out to the chair of the Senate Transportation Committee, Dick Mazza, and then additionally Kurt McCormick from the House of Representatives, who is the chair of the House Transportation Committee, which, you know, would be one of the committees that a bill addressing the use of this system may go through. And neither of them had any clue about this. And then additionally, through talking to Senator Ash, he came out and said, you know, I don't think that there needs to be a change in legislation. And none of them, out of the three of them, none of them have heard anything about conversations around changing legislation since 2017. But according to the Secretary of Transportation, it seems that he and the Agency of Transportation, as well as the Department of Motor Vehicles, has been working with the Attorney General's office to draft some sort of legislation, which is interesting because it's the same Attorney General and the same Attorney General's office that deemed the use of that program illegal under Vermont law.
Yeah, I mean, I can imagine the Attorney General reading current Vermont law and saying, hey, by the letter of the law, we are barred from doing this. Maybe we'd like to do this. So let's see if we can draft some legislation to change that Vermont law. So, I mean, I can understand how the Attorney General might end up in that spot. That's not shocking to me. I guess what is a little bit disturbing maybe is that there just seems to be this ambition that basically there's and a specific instruction from the legislature, the policy-making body in government, let's not do this. But the ambition is not quelled, I mean that's what I think is, and oftentimes there isn't the same sort of accountability or transparency, or it takes some digging by a reporter for the Burlington Free Press in this case, to go find out that these guys are still working on this project even though the legislature has specifically said let's not do it, right?
Yeah, and I asked a lot of questions around that, what is the point of developing and asking for a program that you don't have the approval to use? And the answer is always the same, that it's helpful to have now in case that things change, but, by all accounts, it doesn't seem like legislation is going to change. And if it does, I think it's important to note that with this contract that they signed with this company, it expires in 2023. And so they have an option to renew, I think it's an additional 12 months, and then they have, after that 12 months, they could extend it another 12 months, but after 2025 or so, the contract would be completely done. So they have a window of time to change that legislation. It's hard to predict, what exactly is going to happen next session, but so far it doesn't seem like anything is going to happen. But when I sat down with the Secretary of Transportation, he hoped that, he said along the lines of the media coverage that there might be a renewed conversation in the legislature this coming session.
Well, is there any chance they might say, hey, by the way, we said no a couple of years ago, and here's another chance for us to say no again. We really meant it, and we're sticking with it.
I think we're kind of walking into speculating on what could or couldn't happen, but that's definitely a possibility that's on the table. I think anything is a possibility. It can be, again, really hard to predict what exactly is going to happen in the legislature.
Sure,
January.
Understood.
But,
yeah.
From those top lawmakers that I've talked to, there doesn't really seem to be any active conversation that they're aware of or that they are involved with in changing the legislation. There's still a couple months until January, so things could change.
My guest is Sawyer Loftus. He is a reporter for the Burlington Free Press who's been covering this controversy over whether the Department of Motor Vehicles is going to be using facial recognition software. And I do want to talk with you in a minute, Sawyer, about why does anybody regard this as a scary thing? What is it about facial recognition software that anybody would have a second thought about? But first I want to go to a caller who's been waiting patiently. Wayne from Corinth is on the line. Good morning, Wayne.
Yeah, good morning, and to your guest, too. So this may or may not have anything to do with what we're talking about this morning, but I went through International Airport in Boston a few weeks ago. I have one of the brand new licenses that Motor Vehicle's putting out, and twice during the day I had to go through two separate times through TSA, where they take your license, they look at it, and then they run it through their little scanner. And both times, and on two different scanners, it was completely unreadable. It wouldn't read a single thing off the new license that was issued.
Wow.
I don't know if that has something to do with the curtailing of the facial recognition or what, but it wouldn't read the barcodes, wouldn't read the spatter code, it wouldn't read anything.
That's interesting. Sawyer Loftus, do you know if there's been any other complaints like that?
No, that's the first I've heard of that, and I mean, they did roll out the completely new credentialing system with the new licenses starting July 1st. The only specific thing I've heard is that there were a few bumps, but officials from the Agency of Transportation and the DMV have said that those have quickly been solved. That's the first I have heard of that.
Mine was issued July 2nd, so I got it day. Got it in a timely fashion.
Yep.
Have used it down at Boston. I took my old one with me, too, just in case. Wasn't any problem. They just held it up. They looked at me, and they looked back at the picture. Let me through. X-rayed. I went through again, and I'll be doing that again this weekend. It'll be interesting to see if it works this weekend again or not.
Yeah, I mean, I wonder if it's actually a flaw in the I don't want to call it a document. What in the ID itself, I guess. I mean, is there something there mechanically that's not working, or yeah. I mean, is it a manufacturing flaw, or is it a?
And I was in motor vehicle in Montpelier last week doing some registrations, and I ran it by them, and they hadn't heard of anything either, but they certainly made note of it.
Well, keep us posted on that, Wayne.
I will. I'll see what happens this weekend.
Okay. Yeah. Very interesting. Bye. Thank you. Thanks for the call, Sawyer. Let's go back to that question I was going to ask you a minute ago, which is you mentioned the ACLU a couple of years ago. Got on a campaign about this of sorts, and what is the issue here that people have with facial recognition software?
So I think there are a couple of things at play. There are a lot of concerns over personal privacy, for one, and two, some of the initial concerns that were raised were that, specifically in Vermont, was that Immigration and Custom Enforcement, ICE, was using that database, and there were some reports, and the article from the New York Times presented it as ICE had direct access to that database, and they were using it for immigration purposes. So I think that is something that's scary for Vermonters, and especially, you know, the migrant community that's here. But I think it's important to note that, you know, through the records that are available and that have been given to us from the Department of Motor Vehicles and from the ACLU and from the Agency of Transportation, there is an indication that Homeland Security investigations did ask permission to have a search run for particular suspects, but none of the reasons were listed as immigration related. It does, you know, I mean, I think that is important to note, but I think that's why it's scary, but it's also kind of, it's a newer technology, and I think that can be scary for a lot of people.
There does seem to be a frequent suspicion, and some of it may be well-founded. It's always hard to, you have to really study the individual issue to learn how well-founded these concerns are, but there's this big brother suspicion out there that comes up a lot in connection when you hear about a new technology like this that the government is trying to employ. What are they doing with the information? Does this have any discernible impact on the civil liberties of most ordinary citizens, et cetera, et cetera? Is that the general gist here, or are there specific issues that really make this one stand out?
No, I think that exactly like what you're saying is exactly true about why a lot of people have concerns. I think in Vermont, the ACLU specifically raised concerns over it being used for immigration purposes. But you know, on a wider scale, that is a fear. You know, there's been a lot of coverage lately about, you know, like the federal government accessing data from Google and Facebook, and you know, like Facebook uses its own forms of facial recognition at times. A lot of the iPhones that are coming out now feature Face ID, which is a form of facial recognition. And I think that these subjects are just they're very complex, and they're very difficult to kind of break down and understand. And it can be hard to understand who exactly has access to your information and when they have access to that information.
If the plan is to try to go back to the legislature and seek a change in the law, in other words, basically get permission in Vermont law for the executive branch to use facial recognition software, is there any expectation that such legislation will be filed, you know, come January when lawmakers return to Montpelier?
I think, you know, it's kind of unclear still. It's always possible. When I interviewed Secretary Flynn, he said that they expect the experts around this in the DMV and the Agency of Transportation expect something to happen, but it's difficult to say definitively yes or no, because anything can change. And it's all a matter of what the priorities are. As I understand it, you know, generally, the DMV and the Agency of Transportation will kind of sit down with these key legislators like Senator Mazza, who's the chair of the Transportation Committee, and say, look, these are the things that we would like prioritized or like we would like to see in legislation. So that could happen. It, to my knowledge, has not happened yet, but it could.
Yeah. And Do you think, I mean, sometimes I covered the legislature for quite a while for the Associated Press, and occasionally you see or you don't see. I mean, that's part of the game here, stuff ends up in legislation that perhaps was not supremely well advertised, if you know what I mean.
Mm-hmm.
And so... Yes. I guess for anybody who is concerned about this and wants to see the status quo maintained, where Vermont does not use facial recognition software, or at least is not allowed to under state law, if you want to see that maintained, it probably is going to take some vigilance. Is that fair?
Yeah, I think that's fair. And, you know, Secretary Flynn talked about this, is that if they were to present it, there's a number of ways that that legislation could be presented. It could be presented through their annual DMV bill. It could be presented through a miscellaneous bill. It could be in kind of anything. So it does require a good deal of diligence and vigilance on the behalf of, you know, both legislators and constituents who are interested and passionate and care about this topic.
Yeah, I mean, and is your sense that there are actually people out there? Yeah, I don't know whether it'd be the ACLU just individual citizens who are really tracking this thing. Are there members of the transportation committees who are really opposed to this idea and are going to be watching it like a hawk?
You know, I don't have any specific indications, but I think it's interesting to know, and this is in the story as well. I asked Secretary Flynn, you know, do you expect this to just, if you did introduce something, do you expect it to kind of float through and be kind of like an easy win-win for everyone? And he said, no, he does expect that there will be, you know, a good deal of hesitation and concern that he'll and the Agency of Transportation and the Department of Motor Vehicles will have to overcome.
All right. Well, Sawyer Loftus, unfortunately, we're about out of time on this one, but I appreciate you joining me this morning. Stay on top of it. It sounds like there's more to come on this story.
Yeah, definitely.
So, all righty. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
We're going to take a brief break for some bottom of the hour CBS News here on The Dave Graham Show on WDEV, FM, and AM. And don't forget about our podcast, folks. WDEVradio.com. Follow the link to The Dave Graham Show. Scroll down a bit. You'll find a list of our recent programs. You can listen any time of day or night. All right. We'll go to some CBS News and be back in a couple.
I wish I had a dollar for every compliment I get about our selection upstairs at the Warren Store. This season's collection boasts country casual clothing for men and women, dresses for summer weddings and events, baby clothing from Zuchano and Doodle Pants, and fair trade jewelry from around the world. I'm excited about a new line of pottery from Londonderry, Vermont. Also, illuminated paper stars for outdoor fun. It's a great day trip to Warren Village. Come for lunch on the deck and upstairs for some unique retail therapy. Fun, funky, and friendly, and almost world famous.
Now back to the Dave Graham Show on WDEV, FM, and AM.
And we are back, continuing our program for this Wednesday morning, August 7th, 2019. Thanks so much for staying with us, folks. We have a good segment coming up right now. We're going to be talking about an interesting little controversy in Vermont, and that concerns the dual enrollment program that allows some high school students, juniors and seniors, to take college courses in advance of going off to college. They can save a little money on tuition, on their later tuition bills that way. Sometimes they could also just get a head start on collecting up the credits they're eventually going to need to graduate from college. And it's a really popular program among young Vermonters, and many of them see big advantages in this ability. It's also a way, you know, the bottom line of education, of course, is always expanding the mind. And a lot of high school students are looking around their course offerings in their schools and saying, this stuff doesn't excite me that much. But boy, if I could add what's going on down at the state college or the to the list of possible courses that I can take, that really does expand the offerings that are available to young people. And it's a win-win, generally is the way it comes described. And I believe it. I think it's a good idea. The question is, should the full range of students, those who go to public schools, independent schools, private schools that are out there not taxpayer-funded, but sometimes get taxpayer support via students who come with vouchers from towns that don't have high schools. And then there's a third category of school, of course, in Vermont, which are the sectarian or religious or parochial schools. And there's been a long-time ban on a general pushback against the idea of public funding going to support religious schools. And so Vermont currently does not allow students at religious high schools to participate in the dual enrollment program. And the question is, should the state allow that? Is it a question of fairness for these kids who are enrolled in these religious high schools? And if that's what is being offered to students in public and independent schools, they should have a crack at it too. The pushback there is that would involve some public money going to support the educational program of students at religious schools. And that, of course, has some legal issues connected with it. Let's hear from two people on opposite sides of this question. Dave Sharp was the longtime chair of the House Education Committee. He's a former state rep from Bristol, and he joins us this morning on the phone. Good morning, Dave.
Good morning. How are you, Dave?
I'm doing well. Thanks for joining us. Also, Debbie Ingram is current lawmaker. She is a Democratic senator from Chittenden County and joins us on the phone as well. Good morning, Senator Ingram.
Good morning.
Tell me, I'm going to ask you, Senator Ingram, to kind of go first here because you are one of the people supporting a change. What do you want to see happen here?
I introduced legislation actually last January 2018 to extend our dual enrollment program to those students in the state who attend what we would commonly call parochial schools, religious schools that are independent schools. And right now they are excluded by the law. The dual enrollment program will for students who attend independent schools that are approved and tuitioned by their school districts. And I just think that's, that excludes some students that deserve to be allowed to take college courses as well. And I just think it's not fair.
How many religious high schools are there in Vermont? How big a universe is this?
I don't know the exact number, but it's not a large a number. I want to say around between 30 and 40. And the number of students that we are talking about has remained the same for many years. It's around 12% of our students total that attend independent schools. So it doesn't really. It really vary very much from year to year, so it's not a large number.
Are most of these schools Catholic, or is there a wide range of denominations represented in this group?
There's a range of denominations. There are some that are considered, you know, Protestant, sort of from the evangelical side, but many of them are Catholic.
Okay, and Dave Sharp, let me bring you in here and ask you, you have concerns about this idea of allowing public money to help support the dual enrollment program for students from schools that are basically have a religious purpose.
So I think it's important first to clarify that the proposal that Senator Ingram is making and others have made is that this isn't just for parochial school students. This is for parochial and independent school students. 12% is roughly 8,000 students that would be eligible. So I have three basic objections to dual enrollment, and I worked to try to change the language when the dual enrollment program was presented to the legislature. So my three fundamental objections are, one is that governors and legislators have found the education fund a convenient place to use money on projects other than K-12 public education. So K-12 public education is the requirement in law for the use of the education fund. However, that has been bypassed with the notwithstanding clause that's occasionally used by the legislature. And money has been siphoned out of the education fund for non-K through 12 public school students. And then property taxes go up, and public schools and teachers are blamed for the increase that is partially due to the fact that money's been siphoned out of the education fund for non-K through 12 purposes. Secondly, I would say that dual enrollment was sold to us in the legislature as being an avenue for dealing with the inequity in education between students of means and communities of means and students from low-income families. And despite the efforts of VSAC and the state colleges to actually have low-income students participate, the overwhelming majority of students that do participate in this are students who, A, would have gone to college anyway, and B, come from families that could afford, to the extent that higher education is affordable for anybody, to send their kids to schools of higher education. So it's not fulfilling the mission that the dual enrollment program was sold to the legislature on. And the third thing I would say is that there have been efforts in the state for many years to divert public school money to private institutions. And our tuition program is a perfect example of that. And this is another effort, and it's like I said in the outset, this isn't just about religious schools. This is about all the students who are going to private schools in the state of Vermont.
Well, let me interject something here, Dave, and make sure that I understand correctly. I was under the impression that students who go to independent schools, I'm thinking St. Johnsbury Academy or Thetford Academy, Burn Burton down in the southern part of the state, they are already eligible to participate in the dual enrollment program. Is that the case today?
So I'm not real clear on that.
Do you know, Debbie Ingram, if they are students at independent schools? I'm sorry?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes, you're absolutely right. That's right. As long as the independent school is the district tuitions,
yeah,
for the student to go there, yes, they may participate in the dual enrollment program.
And so, I mean, and this happens quite a bit in Vermont, where a small town doesn't have its own high school, and so it will tell its students, its high school age students, basically to select from nearby schools, which can be public or they can be independent schools. The one place where that stops, from what I understand, is that if the student decides, let's say the student is from Huntington. Huntington may be the wrong example, because it may be part of a school district already. But let's say that if they don't have their own high school there serving that town, a student would be eligible to go to, from there to, you know, any nearby school. They could go to Harwood over in Duxbury. They could go to South Burlington. They could go. But the one place they couldn't go would be Rice High School in South Burlington, which is a Roman Catholic school, because then you would end up with public money flowing to, I mean, they could go there, but they couldn't go there with the town's support. Is that right?
Yes, that's right.
It's somewhat confusing because there's so-called tuitioning, and then there's vouchers. So, and I'm not totally clear on how it works currently. But I'm not sure a student from Huntington could go to Phillips Exeter, for example. And if they could, maybe they could only take a voucher amount of X number of dollars. I think it might be $14,000. And then the difference between the $14,000 and the $30,000 that the school pays has to be made up by the parents. But
yeah,
it doesn't, these details don't negate my concern is that what it's doing is taking money in the education fund that should be used, in my view, should be used for public education, K through 12 public education, and using it for sending students to Phillips Exeter or Rice or other private institutions And what this does is, in the long run, bifurcate our school system so that students of well-to-do families get to have choice. Isn't that the golden chalice, is to have choice? So they get to have choice to go to any school in the world, and in fact, Vermont tax dollars have in the past gone to Sweden and Argentina. I remember those two in particular, where we were paying Vermont tax dollars to have students attend private schools in those countries. Hmm. So anywhere in the world, they can take this voucher and spend Vermont tax dollars, while kids who have no transportation and have to attend their local public high school are going to their public high school with restricted amount of money, because a certain amount is being spent on vouchers in private schools, and the public gets all upset about their tax dollars. I don't blame the public for being upset about their tax dollars. I also think that free tuition to Vermont State Colleges for every student in Vermont would be a good idea, but neither of those things are addressed properly with the dual enrollment program.
Let me ask Senator Debbie Ingram to respond to some of this and get you to address this issue of bifurcation, as Dave Sharp calls it, in the educational system in Vermont. Do you see that as a problem? Do you think that there's, or is he overstating it, or where do you come down on that?
Well, I think, you know, historically we've had these independent schools, like you mentioned before, like St. John's Ferry Academy and Burr and Burton. And so in certain parts of the state, the system has been bifurcated for, you know, well over 100 years. So we have that, and that is a reality of our current system. But as I said at the beginning, that number of students remains constant and has for many years. So I don't think we're doing, you know, any damage to our public school system. And then what Mr. Sharp is talking about in terms of the dual enrollment program specifically, the money goes not to the high school. The money goes not to the high school student. The money goes to the post-secondary institution at which the student wants to take college-level classes while they're still in high school.
Okay, so let me stop you there and give you an example that was presented to me, yesterday, by a young man who actually went to Rice High School in South Burlington. He's our summer intern, Jack Lyons, here at WDEV, and he pointed up what sounded pretty ironic to me, which is that you could have a student from a public high school do a dual enrollment program and take the classes, the college level classes, at St. Michael's College in Colchester, Roman Catholic mm-hmm. College, and that would be okay. But mm-hmm. if you were a student at Rice and you wanted at the Catholic high school and you want to take classes at a public college like University of Vermont, that's not okay. Is something backwards here?
Absolutely, he is absolutely right, and I agree with him. It is backwards, and that's what motivated me to introduce the legislation in the first place. Was my, you know, Rice High School is in my district, and mm-hmm. Some of my constituents, you know, came to me and explained the situation to me, and they said it's, you know, not fair, and they, you know, they pay their property taxes, they pay into this program, and then their children can't take advantage of it. And it is designed, you know, one of the problems that was identified is that we have a very high rate of high school graduation in Vermont. I think it's over 95%, but we have only about 40% of Vermonters who go on to college.
Yeah, post-secondary.
So,
yeah.
You're right. Yeah. So my understanding was, I was in the legislature when this was originally passed, but my understanding was it was meant to try to encourage students to go to our state colleges. And yes, that includes some private institutions like St. Michael's.
So if I could interject here for just a minute.
Sure, yep.
I agree with Senator Ingram on this point. And it's one of the things that I would encourage the legislature to change is, so make the dual enrollment program for the students, the 60% of students who don't go on to college. I think the evidence is that the overwhelming number of students that participate in dual enrollment would be part of the 40% that are going to college anyway. So design the program for low-income students or for students that may have some other impediment to going on to college, and design a program that in fact raises that 40% number, not a program that just takes money out of the education fund to pay for kids who have means, who would go to college anyway, to spend on college.
Let's get a caller on the line here. Rich from Starksboro is calling in. Good morning, Rich.
Good morning. Homeschoolers are allowed to use the dual enrollment program, and a vast number of parents homeschool their children for religious reasons. Now, would the this seems like we want to do an extension to have them pass a litmus test to see whether they're homeschooling their children for religious reasons. Therefore, we can't allow them, and we can't along with the churches. It seems kind of ridiculous to me, but. Just a comment about the former representative's comments about the the dual enrollment program. It seems his comments are really geared toward eliminating the program, which may not be a bad idea. Then we don't get into all these unfairness issues and stuff. But those are my comments. Thank you.
All right. Thanks for the call, Rich. Appreciate it. Dave Sharp, let me go to you on that. I mean, it sounded like you take a pretty dim view of the dual enrollment program overall, correct?
Well, I think it was sold to, it was sold to the legislature on the basis it was going to help the 60%, mostly low-income kids who wouldn't otherwise go to college, and this is going to open the door and get more of our kids to take college, and we're going to raise that 40% number to 60% number. And there's an effort underway in Vermont to do exactly that that I've been a part of. It was called 70 by 2025. It has a new name, I think, Advanced Vermont or something like that. Mm-hmm. And I think that's a great goal. I think efforts at like that Tennessee has to offer scholarships or incentives or a process where we get low-income students to go on to higher education. We know that roughly two-thirds of the jobs in the future are going to require education beyond high school, whether that's an electrician's license or a bachelor's degree. And we know we have 40% of the kids pursuing that type of education. We have tremendous work to do.
And Dave, I got to cut you off there, unfortunately, because we are at about the end of this segment. I thank you so much for joining us this morning. Former Representative Dave Sharp of Bristol and Senator Debbie Ingram of Chittenden County, thank you as well. And we are going to go to a CBS News break at the top of the hour here. Back with more of the Dave Graham Show to follow. Stay with us, folks.
I wish I had a dollar for every compliment I get about our selection upstairs at the Warren Store. This season's collection boasts country casual clothing for men and women, dresses for summer weddings and events, baby clothing from Zucciano and Doodle Pants, and fair trade jewelry from around the world. I'm excited about a new line of pottery from Londonderry, Vermont. Also, illuminated paper stars for outdoor fun. It's a great day trip to Warren Village. Come for lunch on the deck and upstairs for some unique retail therapy. Fun, funky, and friendly, and almost world famous.
News Radio, WDEV, FM, and AM. Now back to the Dave Graham Show.
Yes, indeed, we are back. We are continuing into the second hour of our Dave Graham Show for Wednesday, August the 7th, 2019. And we like to go after the top of the hour CBS News break to one of our correspondents from Talk Media News. And I've been so busy with trying to line up other guests for future shows, even on the commercial breaks here, that I'm trying to remember who I've got coming on from Talk Media News. I don't think they're on the phone yet, so I guess we'll find out when they call in. Meanwhile, we do have a caller on the line who might bail me out here. How about Dave from Greensboro? Good morning, Dave.
Dave?
How are you?
Yeah, I'm great. Listen, I wanted to make a couple of comments about dual enrollment, because first, I don't think Dave Sharp fully appreciates the value. We have a large segment of students, especially in their senior year, who are just warehoused in some of our public high schools. And Act 77 has given them a chance to make their senior year incredibly valuable. dual enrollment is valuable for multiple reasons. While I was chair of the Hazen School Board, I also fully appreciated tuitioning because we received tuition students from Wolcott and Walden. Those towns would never give up tuitioning, and they made us up our game. To attract students from those towns, we had to create a really great arts and music program, which we did because we had to compete with St. Johnsbury Academy and Stowe High School and other schools. I don't think Mr. Sharp fully understood either the value of tuitioning to all of our public schools or the value of dual enrollment. And I would also say it's absolutely a no-brainer to stop discriminating against Catholic students. Senator Ingram is absolutely right.
All right. Thanks for the call, Dave. I appreciate it. We'll talk soon.
Thank you for taking my call.
Yep. Bye. All right. Hey, we do have Bob Ney on the line from Talk Media News with us. Good morning, Bob.
Good morning. How are you, Dave?
I'm doing all right, and I want to check in with you about some of the repercussions from events this past weekend after the mass shootings last weekend. Gun violence has displaced immigration as the most talked about news topic on social media for the first time since May, according to data from NewsWhip. This is thank you very much for sending me this email this morning, Bob, to fill me in on some of what we're going to talk about. That's interesting. So we are at a place where gun violence has displaced immigration as the most talked about news story on social media. I guess I'm not surprised. Are you?
No, I'm not. And this is by Axios, AXIOS. It's a relatively new news service. And the way they look at this is not to determine for or against, but how much items are served and talked about, and they count all that. So I just wanted to point out it's a very legitimate, survey type of group. But anyway, yes, it's taken the forefront. And, normally these tragedies have occurred, and then we almost got used to them. This one seems to have a different tone to it. It really does.
I think
El Paso and Dayton.
Pardon the description, but it was double-barreled. Two in one weekend. That's basically that's an overdose, I would say, and I think I really do think that if it were one and then you wait a week and there's another one, it probably wouldn't have anywhere near the impact. But this idea that it's popping up in El Paso, it's popping up in Dayton mere hours later, I think America is finally waking up here and saying this is enough. We got to do something.
Right, because I thought, frankly, after like a classroom of kids were killed, you can pick whichever school shooting you want. They're all tragic. I thought, something would happen, and a lot didn't happen. And also, and I just wanted to mention this, and this is, I'm not trying to throw politics in here, but we have to remember at one time that Barack Obama was president, Nancy Pelosi was Speaker of the House, and you had a Democratic-controlled Senate with Harry Reid, and nothing passed through, basically, of substance. So I did want to point out, despite past shootings and mass shootings, et cetera, no matter what the scenario was or the combination, it didn't seem like things happened. This one may have a different possibility. Now, of course, the question is what happens. And I think once we have to wait for the political side of it to quiet down, because right now it's Beto O'Rourke, for example, and President Trump out front, arguing about the president's trip to El Paso, and so you've got that going on, and that needs to subside a little bit and then get to the issue.
Yeah, I gotta ask you though, in the case of President Trump, I actually looked at a list of Mother Jones is a left-leaning magazine, but they had appeared to be a pretty straightforward list of mass shootings since 1982 in the United States of America. And I counted them up and divided by the number of months the presidents have been in office. So 96 for Obama, the number of months in 8 years, 30.5 for Trump so far. And I developed a statistic I'm calling deaths by mass shooting per month. So how many people are dying in mass shootings per month? The rate at which people are dying has more than doubled under President Trump. And, is that all President Trump's fault? I don't think anybody can prove that. Does his rhetoric help when he's talking about an invasion by immigrants, when he's talking about infestations and so on? Does that help? What do we think?
No, I don't think it helps. I mean, I think that they have to be careful. It's just like almost anything said. Then, of course, you got to watch to the censorship side. But people in public office, yes, I think it. They've got to be extra sensitive. They can talk about the issue and the gangs that come, MS-13, et cetera, you know, that come over. But, yes, some of the things are a problem. And it's just I always point back just in a fairness angle because people say, well, you're picking on President Trump. But, you know, I'll point back to Congresswoman Omar. I mean, when you say, you know, about the Benjamins and Jewish people and things like that, that could stir, you know, some hatred to say, well, we ought to, you know, do something about it. I mean, there's all kinds of examples, I guess, we can use, but he is the president of the United States. And so, therefore, you know, things that he says might be taken, you know, by some and absolutely, of course, the way they shouldn't be.
He's, I mean, anything he says way more influential than a first-term member of Congress.
Yeah, although when you start to talk, you know, as she did about Jewish people, I think she's inflammatory. I mean, I just really don't care for some of the things she said.
I'm not excusing that either. I'm just saying that in terms of, you know, when you are out there on this repeated basis, you know, not it's not like a one-time thing. You know, you're calling majority black countries assholes, and you're calling this and that city infested, and then you're referring to Omar and the other three congresswomen of color and saying they should go back to where they came from.
I think he could have achieved his objectives a lot differently and more effectively had he not been as harsh as he is. You know, I mean, he's probably the harshest president, you know, in one of the few of all time. So, yes, I agree that, you know, he is unfiltered in what he responds.
Yeah, I wonder.
Again, I think the mass shootings, you know, I looked at the definitions of the mass shootings, too, 4 or 5 people. And, of course, then you look at Chicago that had, I don't know, 60 in a weekend. Yeah. And those are more, you know, I wouldn't blame that one on Trump whatsoever, you know, because it's just individual shootings, but they happen to be shooting 4 or 5 people at a time.
Yeah, although I wouldn't be surprised if some of them aren't a result of just the general climate of anger and angst in the country right now.
Well, look, there's a lot of people, and, you know, I go to India twice a year, and my friends all tell me the same thing. We're praying for you while you're in India, or we're praying for you, and I'll write back on email, why am I in America?
Yeah.
what do you
mean? I mean, I shouldn't laugh. It's tragic.
I'm not going to be in. Oh, I do. I tell them. I'm not going to be. My chances of being hurt in India are far less than being hurt in my hometown.
That's a sad fact.
There's anger here. I mean, putting Trump aside and these statements and all Omar and everything, there's a lot of anger here. I mean, you know, Memphis, Tennessee has a special unit just for road rage.
I have heard that, yeah. And I mean, that's kind of amazing to me that it would be Memphis you'd hear about that coming from first, because there's getting pretty close to the Deep South there. And you know, I used to, my image of the Deep South, of course, I'm from New England, so what do I know? But it used to be that people were almost exaggeratedly, if that's a word, polite nice, you know, sort of sweet to each other, in at least in certain respects. So that the idea of somebody just, you know, getting into road rage incidents on the streets of Memphis, I'm like, what? What's going on here?
You know, and I was in public office 24 years, and I've said this way before I started to report news, you know, I noticed a trend, honestly, of phone calls in to our offices from what they used to be, you know, the nature and the tempo and the anger. It just, by the time I left office, it was like, wow. I mean, people would call in and basically almost threaten the front desk girl that answered the phone, you know.
Bob, speaking of phone calls, I have a caller on the line. Do you have a minute to take a call here?
Sure.
Let's hear from Robert from Williamstown. Good morning, Robert.
This is Rama from Williamstown.
Rama, I'm sorry.
Dave, this is directed at you because your Republican apologist from D.C. who calls in, and you go along with this too, incidentally. We have Trump sitting in the White House, who is an obvious racist, who goes out to campaign rallies and runs Nuremberg-style rallies where he actively incites hatred and violence. And you guys want to taper this off is by saying, yeah, but what about everybody else? Well, screw everybody else. What about that racist rapist in the White House? When these clowns call up from D.C., rest assured, Dave, I'm turning off the radio. I am sick of listening to apologists for hate speech coming over from the President of the United States. Thank you.
All right. You know what? Hey, Rama, hang on a sec. Are you still there?
Yeah.
All right. I'm going to let Bob go because he's got to go on to his next thing. But I appreciate it, Bob. But we'll talk soon. Rama, I want to respond to what you're saying here. I don't feel like I'm making excuses for Trump here. I just cited a statistic saying that the rate of mass shooting deaths per month had doubled under Trump as compared to what it was under Obama. I mean, I think that's a very striking statistic, and I don't know, you know, how much.
Yeah, but you're talking to this guy from D.C., and you're letting this conversation go off to blame other people for what Trump's doing.
I said I don't necessarily agree with everything Omar has done, this congresswoman from Minnesota, but I don't really think that's completely relevant either. I mean, and that's why I pushed back and I said, isn't the president much, much more influential than this?
I did not hear much pushback. And Dave, I'll tell you where my frustration listening to you comes from, and this comes from listening to you talk about things like the Catholic Church. Also, that you try to find excuses to ameliorate the obvious damage that these organizations and individuals are doing to our country.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's really frustrating to listen when there's an international organization that as an organizational level has aided and abetted at a minimum by covering up child abuse and child rape. And people are saying, oh, well, we can fix it. We can fix it, and trying to make excuses by saying all the good things we do. Or they have people like Trump who comes out and actively incites racial violence. And people go, oh, yeah, but look at the unemployment rate. You know, these are things that don't cut it anymore. This is today. You know?
I think we're closer to agreement than you want to let on. I also do want to say that in some instances, organizations and institutions and even individuals have a mix of behaviors. You know, the Catholic Church also founded our first universities and contributed an awful lot to art and music and all that sort of stuff over the centuries.
You know, too big to fail is killing us.
Yeah.
Walmart got away with mistreating thousands upon thousands upon thousands of employees because they were too big to be held responsible for each of their individual stores. The Catholic Church can't be held responsible because they're a religion and a worldwide organization.
They're being held responsible.
And Trump can't be.
They're about bankrupt, and that's how responsible they're being held.
Really? When I see all the churches sold off, when I see all the gold and silver this is and that's in their churches being sold off, when I see the preachers selling their frocks to help feed the hungry, I don't believe. Well, I'm sorry. I get you.
I do have to go, but I think thank you for the call. We'll talk soon. Hey, let's go to Jeff from Moncton. Good morning, Jeff. Good morning, Jeff. Jeff has decided not to join us, I guess, after all. Oh, you there?
Yeah. Hey, Dave, you there?
Yeah.
Again, I just like your last caller to explain what exactly Trump has been accused of or proven or found guilty of as far as racism and all that goes.
Well, when you call a majority of black countries assholes, when you call Mexicans rapists,
the reason I say that, Dave, and I've been wanting to call in for a couple of weeks and say this. Okay, you keep referring back to his tweet about the congresswomen and he called them this and he said that about them.
Yeah.
Go back to that actual tweet and tell me who he actually called out, or is it the news media saying, hey, it was about them? He never actually named anybody.
Oh, come on. It's so obvious.
Dave?
It's so obvious who he was talking about.
You say that. It's obvious to you.
It's obvious to like 99% of Americans, Jeff.
But again, Dave, the news media, and I'm not singling you out. I'm saying the news media in general thought that this would be a better story if they said it was about these four women.
Okay? Well, the four women certainly took it as about them.
he never and that he never actually called.
So Trump's fellow Republicans have taken it as about the Ford congresswoman,
and that's fine. But he never actually called anybody.
The crowd at his rally who said time. Send her back. Who is the her? And who is the her they wanted to send back?
Every time that this story gets brought up, you guys keep saying, "Well, it's about them."
Who was the her the crowd wanted to send back?
It could be multiple people.
Yeah. Well, guess what? Her is a singular word. They didn't say send them back. So it's not multiple people. It's one person. Okay. Who's the her?
You're right.
Help me out here, pal. Come on.
I'm just asking, who is the her?
Yeah, the her is Ilhan Omar, a congresswoman from Minnesota who came from Somalia to this country, a great American story about an immigrant rising up to get elected to Congress. That's the her.
Absolutely not disagreeing with you. But do you know definitively it's her?
I do.
You know definitively.
I'd bet my next paycheck on it. Yep, absolutely. Hey, Jeff, I got to go. I got a guest coming in, but I appreciate the call. Don't be shy. I know I'm yelling at you, but you are kind of getting on my nerves. We'll talk again soon.
Yep, bye.
Bye. Let's hear from Gene from Barrie. Good morning, Gene.
Good morning. You've been getting a lot of nice calls.
Oh, yeah, it's a beautiful thing, isn't it?
Well, mine's going to be a little different.
Okay.
We know how Trump is, and he's not going to change.
Yeah.
So, anyway.
I just want to say, folks, I'm too liberal for Rich, and I'm too conservative for Rama.
Yeah.
So I don't know what the heck's going on here.
Well, I read an article in a magazine about a month ago. This is four things that's going to get to this country. The first, it says the low crop prices. The second is the global war, the trade war.
Mm-hmm.
The third was weather, the weatherization where we got floods and all this stuff.
Yeah.
The fourth is Bible prophecy.
Okay.
So you can concentrate on a lot of these farms, you probably have heard, are going out in the Midwest. They've gone through bankruptcy, farmers.
Yeah, it is tough time on farms.
It said when famine gets to this country, other countries are not going to sell to us, it says, because of what the president is doing to these other countries. And they're holding it against us, not maybe the people, but the country. So they're not going to say they're not going to sell food or anything to us.
Yeah.
So I don't know. So this is not Bible prophecy if you want to read the book of Revelations.
Yeah, that's...
I'm not turning the religion onto people, but it's going to be up to them, right?
Well, it might be. We'll see.
Yeah.
Gene, I got to go. Thank you for the call.
Well, you have a good day.
You too. All right. I want to introduce my next guest here on the Dave Graham Show on WDEV, FM, and AM, and that is Scott Giles. He's in the studio with us this morning. He is the president, CEO of the Vermont Student Assistance Corporation, Winooski-based organization, which is, I knew it was one of those W's up there in Chittenden County. It's a Winooski-based organization, which operates statewide and helps students from Vermont get their higher educations under their belts, lots of different loans and grants and scholarships and advice, especially advice on how to manage the finances of this increasingly expensive thing we call higher education. And it's a time of year when a lot of families in Vermont, of course, are about to send their kids off to some more higher education. And the question is always this time of year, look at this giant bill. How are we going to pay this? And that sort of thing. So we're going to learn a little bit about that from Scott Giles. Scott, thanks very much for coming in this morning.
Dave, thank you very much for having me.
And tell us a little bit about, it seems like there are some fluctuations in the calendar of your life, the life of ESAC and the life of higher education and its financing, et cetera. And there are different times of year families need to be thinking about different types of activities related to all this. What does August look like out there?
Sure. I think as you indicated, VSAC was created to make sure that all Vermonters have access to both the information, kind of career and education counseling that they need, and the financial resources to pursue their education or training after high school. So we're supporting families that are pursuing traditional kind of higher education, 2 and 4 year degrees, but also folks that are pursuing trades and or certificate programs that lead to good jobs. Kind of August is a period when we see a real uptick in the work that we are doing with students, families, and of students who are kind of heading off to traditional kind of higher education. We've got students like your intern, Jack, who is getting ready to return to his school, I think, for his junior year, mm-hmm. and is probably right now in the midst of trying to figure out the last bit of that bill in order to be able to make sure that he keeps his registration. Then we've got a group of what I call the brand new folks. You know, these were students who just graduated in, kind of June, and they're getting ready to go off to school for the first time. This is a group that we spend a lot of time with because this will be the first time they've seen that bill that you're talking about. And we spend a lot of time on the phone and in person and with our counselors who live and work all across the state, serving students in nearly every high school, kind of providing some counseling to make sure that families are able to pull together all the resources they need to be successful.
So these are VSAC employees who go to high schools and actually counsel kids on what you need to be thinking about in terms of if you want to get a higher education, how are you going to pay for it and that sort of thing. Is that right?
Yeah, absolutely. And, they live and work in the regions, in the, their same regions, work with first-gen low-income students in nearly every high school. But beyond just that particular caseload, we've got a mission of serving all Vermonters. And these counselors are doing paying for college nights and forms nights throughout the fall. So for students, those rising seniors of high school and their families, be on the lookout for a note from either your school counselor or from VSAC that one of our counselors is going to be doing a presentation right in your community.
All right, point of personal privilege. I've got a 30-year-old son who's thinking about going back for a career change and getting a certificate as a teacher, mm-hmm. and the teacher apprenticeship program. And, you know what? We should talk about more about this after the break. I think we actually just have a few seconds to go before we got to get some CBS news in and a couple words from our sponsors. So I'll finish this question after we come back. We'll be back on the Dave Graham Show here in just a couple minutes, folks.
I wish I had a dollar for every compliment I get about our selection upstairs at the Warren Store. This season's collection boasts country casual clothing for men and women, dresses for summer weddings and events, baby clothing from Zuchano and Doodle Pants, and fair trade jewelry from around the world. I'm excited about a new line of pottery from Londonderry, Vermont. Also, illuminated paper stars for outdoor fun. It's a great day trip to Warren Village. Come for lunch on the deck and upstairs for some unique retail therapy. Fun, funky, and friendly, and almost world famous.
Now back to the Dave Graham Show on WDEV, FM, and AM.
Well, and I wanted to continue with that discussion that we were just interrupted by the bottom of the hour break. I was asking Scott Giles of the Vermont Student Assistance Corporation. You mentioned, Scott, that your services are available to Vermonters of all ages. It's not just college-age students you're helping out. And I started to mention I have a 30-year-old son who's thinking about going back for a teaching certificate. He has an undergraduate degree in Spanish and, says, well, maybe I should think about being a high school Spanish teacher, but I would need to get this teaching certificate. There are a couple different programs in Vermont that offer this credential. And what can VSAC do for this guy?
Sure. I really appreciate the question because so often when we're talking about our work, it's easy for us to focus on what I'll call the traditional age students. We have a whole program plus grant money that's available to what we'll call adult students or non-traditional students. And it is kind of very common for us to work with adults who may be 19 years old to 62 or 63 years old who for whatever reason, maybe they've lost a job, they're stuck in a job where they're not able to earn enough money or they need additional education or training to get the next promotion. We've got counselors across the state that provide really very similar career and education services that we provide to younger students, help them map out, their career goals, what education or training, so it may be a certificate program like your son or training program. And then this year, we're kind of excited for the kind of first time in 6 years, the legislature actually provided an increase in funding for our non-degree grant program, which is a financial aid program targeted towards adult students to provide support to allow them to do just exactly the kinds of things that you're talking about.
To get that, maybe there's a certificate. Various industries and employers have specific training you can get to move up to the next job duty, for instance, and sometimes you're adding, I mean, you may be working in a manufacturing setting where you are certified to run certain types of machinery, but not others, and this is something that would enable people to expand there, and then usually you get paid a little more if you're able to operate a broader range of the equipment at the plant, right?
Yeah, you know, absolutely. I tell this story often. For some individuals, they need a single course. We were working with a woman down in the Brattleboro area who's working as a bookkeeper. She needed an accounting course in order to be qualified for the next promotion, mm-hmm. kind of within the small company that she was working for. She was able to use the non-degree grant in order to take an accounting class at CCV, successfully took it, got the promotion, and was able to get a full-time job with benefits that allowed her to support her family.
That's moving up, folks, and that's what a lot of what VSAC is devoted to. Let me return to this we were describing earlier, this time on the calendar, what families need to be thinking about and what students need to be thinking about as they plan their next educational steps. And one cohort I was interested in getting your thoughts about, Scott Giles, CEO of VSAC, would be younger high school kids. I mean, somebody who's what they call these days a rising senior. That's a piece of terminology I'm just getting familiar with. I guess it means somebody who is going to be a senior, or if you're a rising sophomore, you've finished your freshman year and you're going to be in the 10th grade, I guess, if it's a high school setting in the fall. Anyway, so somebody in who's in between right now, a summer vacation between sophomore and junior year, or junior and senior year, what should they be thinking about for their college financing and educational plans and so on?
Well, one of the things that I really encourage every junior and senior to consider, I think as you had a discussion in part about this in your earlier call, Vermont makes two free dual enrollment classes available to virtually every Vermont junior and senior, at least kind of attending a public institution. Obviously, there's a question about the independent schools and the parochial schools that the legislature and the courts still need to resolve. Those are great opportunities for students of all, backgrounds, but particularly students that are maybe concerned that, they may not have everything, they may not have all the skills they need in order to be able to be successful in college. Dual enrollment gives them a chance to, go to a CCV or to any one of the other participating Vermont institutions, take a class, and kind of prove to themselves that, yep, I really can do this. It's also a great opportunity to explore some of your interests and get a little clearer picture of what it is that you want to study. So, we always start there. The other thing is, this is a great time as you're thinking about programs to start visiting college campuses. Take a look at a college campus or visit a training program if that's where your interest, lies, and get a feel for, whether or not, this is a place that you think that you would like to be. And then, kind of finally, once the school year for that senior kind of starts in earnest, as I mentioned, our counselors are paying for college nights in virtually every high school in the state. That's a great opportunity for a student and his or her parents to sit down and get an introduction in the kind of soup to nuts of kind of financing education.
Yeah, someone had once advised me that your first visit to a school should not be the admissions interview. It should be, you should have been to the school previously to look around as somebody who's just maybe thinking about applying there, as opposed to somebody who's in the process of applying already. And does that make sense?
I think that every family is different, but mm-hmm. I think any opportunity that you get to go onto a campus, we do this a lot with the students that are in our current education counseling programs. We'll give them a chance to talk to some students there to get a feel for students that they know, what their experience is like, and take a look at the campus, maybe talk to a professor, get a feel for the programs and learn a little bit more about the class size with an eye towards, is this a place that I would feel comfortable and could be successful?
Talk to the students, too.
Yeah, absolutely.
Check in with, and say, how do you like it here? What do you, are you glad you came here? Any regrets, et cetera, et cetera? Just a very informal basis. I mean, it's better to do it as informally as possible, I would think, and then get the real lowdown as opposed to going for the formal tour, you know, when you're there and there, and the institution is trying very hard to sell itself to you and make you interested, and you're maybe in the, if you're going to an actual admissions interview or some kind of a, I mean, if you're in the looking into the fine arts theater or music or something, and you're there for your audition, it may be later in the process than you really want it to be, and you're just starting to get acquainted with the place. That, again, if you'd come a year before and looked around and gotten a flavor for it, it might be an easier process, just a sort of easier way in, I guess.
And one of the things I encourage with the students that I get a chance to talk to and work with is easy icebreaker. You're on a campus, stop a random student on campus and ask for directions.
Mm-hmm.
You know, how to find something. A great way to start a conversation. You actually learn a lot. You know, when folks are like, oh, let me help you and walk you
here.
Right. Yep. It tells you something about what the community is like. But then you can ask the student a little bit, you know, how did they decide to come here? What is it that they really like? What are they studying?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And things of that nature.
And it's just a process of familiarization, which can be nothing but helpful as far as I can tell. So, Scott Giles of VSAC, I do want to turn the conversation back to the original sort of broad theme, and that is, you know, August of a year when you are about to go off to college for the first time, or you are about to go off to a training program, or maybe you're returning for year 2, 3, 4 of one of these programs. What are you thinking about in terms of how VSAC can help with the continuing process of education?
I think the first thing that I would like to leave everybody with is the knowledge that you're not going through this by yourself, and that our team at VSAC stands ready to provide you kind of any and all of the assistance that we can, whether it's figuring out the financial aid, making sense of all the different student loan options that are out there, pulling your package together. You know, if you're in the Chittenden County area, you can come visit us. If you're elsewhere in the state, you can reach out to one of our counselors, and you can always call us on our toll-free number to kind of talk through any kind of questions or challenges you might have.
And are you actually going around, I gather, not so much at the schools, because the schools are out of session, the public schools and independent schools in Vermont right now, but I don't know, having community meetings in libraries or other venues to talk to folks right now?
Yeah, and taking a lot of phone calls. So mm-hmm. we've got a lot of folks that are calling to kind of set up, counseling questions, particularly for those students that are embarking on college for the first time. One of the things that we see that, worries us from a higher education perspective, particularly true of students whose parents didn't have a higher education background themselves. Every 2 years we survey every high school senior, and we talk about the fact that Vermont has high graduation rates, high school graduation rates, but only about 60% of our high school seniors go on to some form of education or training. 17% of the high school seniors who say they're going to be on a campus next year will not show up. And one of the things that we have discovered kind of over time is that while they were high school seniors, they had support from teachers and the school counselors. During that summer period, unless their parents are really knowledgeable and skilled at navigating this process, those 3 months are kind of a period when they don't have a lot of support. And, you know, they're expected to register, take a look at orientation. They've got bills that they have to navigate. And we lose a lot of students, particularly, lower middle and first generation students. This is a group that we are really focused, in addition to trying to make sure that we reach out to them to make sure they know that in VSAC they have the support they'll need in order to navigate this process.
I would think that is a problem which may even be exacerbated for kids who want to take a gap year. They finish their senior year in high school and they're saying, okay, I think I want to go to college, but I'm going to take a year off, go to work, save up some money, And now they're in that realm where they may be working at a fairly low-level, low-wage job somewhere. They don't have the daily interactions with teachers and guidance counselors who are sort of in that educational frame of mind. And, I mean, it seems like if you're thinking about kids being lost over a three-month summer, 12-month period is that much longer.
Yeah, I'm about to say something that may generate a phone call, because gap years are an important tool for some students.
Mm-hmm.
But to the point that you're making, when we take a look at our research, if you're a student who knows you're going on to post-secondary education and you are able to participate in a structured gap year,
mm-hmm.
the message that we have to that student is apply to schools first, so that when you get done with your gap year, you've already applied to institutions. You've probably been accepted by some. Maybe you deferred for a year, but you have a plan in place for when your gap year ends. For some students, they need to work for that year. We encourage the same thing, because one of the things that we have seen is that, once you're working for that year, you've lost the supports from your high school, the chances that you're going to go on to some form of education or training after high school drops by about 20%.
Hmm. Scott Giles, I want to ask you a question that has been coming to me a little more frequently recently than I remembered it occurring, decades ago. It goes like this. With the rising cost of higher education, some young people, some families are looking at the situation and saying, is this really worth it? Are we actually getting a good return on our investment when some schools are upwards of $60,000 a year now for tuition, room, and board? Others are in the 30 to 40 range for a fairly mid-level school these days. And meanwhile, I was mentioning to you on the break that I had a guest on the other day, Betsy Bishop of the Vermont Chamber of Commerce, who was telling us that 26% of the jobs available in Vermont actually require a four-year degree. That tells me, and I didn't have to go to college for this math, but that tells me that 74% of the jobs available do not require a four-year degree. What should we be thinking about all this?
Well, one of the things that we at VSAC really focus on is trying to help families be good consumers of education. And I think that there are two sides of this equation that we really try and work and kind of struggle with. One is that Federal Reserve came out with a study, 2 years ago that basically reaffirmed that, on average, even with student debt, an individual that gets a four-year degree is significantly better off over their lifetime than somebody that has just a high school diploma. What I think is interesting and is changing within our world is that there's a whole range of new education and training options that are coming available that don't necessarily involve a four-year degree that can lead to, really good, productive jobs. A little while ago, I was at, a program, and you get programs like this at some of our tech centers as well, the Advanced Welding Institute in Vermont. The students go through an 12 to 18 month program there, and they're graduating and getting $60,000 and $65,000 starting jobs.
Hmm.
Obviously with benefits, and those are great wages. For an investment that's substantially less than a 4 year degree.
Is there a danger? The old model of higher education, if you were going to college, you were probably going to have to do some core requirements, say in the liberal arts. Maybe take you might get out with an engineering degree, but it's somewhere along the way you took a course in Shakespeare or something, or you might get out with a degree in psychology, but somewhere along the way you took a course in higher level mathematics. And I'm wondering whether that broad education will tend to get lost if we get into more sort of a specialized certificate environment.
Mm-hmm. I think there's always a danger there, and I think that's why when we take a look at the national statistics, why the Federal Reserve data is still showing that the more education you have on average, the higher your earnings will be over time. Because it's very hard to be able to identify the specific portion of the education that you got that is directly relevant to your work. So we're strong supporter of encouraging families to pursue as much education, as they want and can obtain, while knowing that they've got alternatives available to them.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting. If I think about my own case, I got a degree in journalism and English from UMass Amherst years and years ago now. And I think back and I sort of say to myself, I probably remember, I don't know, three or four things from my journalism classes that I probably could have learned in a couple of days. And instead, it was spread out over 4 years. And so what did I do? What was all that about? And obviously, you know, I did take a couple of classes in Shakespeare and creative writing and other topics, some music classes, et cetera. And so I thoroughly enjoyed and found it to be a very rewarding and enriching environment to just hang out on a big university campus for that time. But I can sort of see how you could make a different decision.
Mm-hmm. You know, I think that, you know, that's part of the complexity and part of why I think we are so energized by the work that we're doing with Vermont students and families. These are complex decisions. We've got experience working with, you know, really tens of thousands of students and their families every year. And we're a resource so that Vermont families don't need to go through this by themselves.
That is a good thing to know. Of the Vermont Student Assistance Corporation, if folks want to reach out to you, how do they find you?
You know, you can go to our website. You can call our toll-free number, which is 833-802-VSAC. Mm-hmm. Or you can reach out to your school counselor and find out how to connect with one of our career and education counselors around the state.
That is good to know. Good information. And folks, don't be shy. You know, VSAC is there, there to help you mark your path forward through higher education in Vermont. And so, Scott Giles, I want to thank you very much for joining me this morning to fill us in on the latest from VSAC. Glad to have you.
Dave, thank you very much for having me again.
And that's going to about wrap us up for today's edition of the Dave Graham Show here on WDEV FM and AM. Don't forget about our podcast. Go to WDEVradio.com. Follow the link to the Dave Graham Show. Scroll down a bit. You'll find a list of our recent programs in case you missed any of this interview with Scott Giles or any of the others this morning. I want to thank all my guests. Stay tuned now for the Bill Sayre Show, Common Sense Radio. And we'll be back tomorrow with another edition of the Dave Graham Show on WDEV AM and FM. Have a great day, everybody.